It is Monday, October the 17th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, Syria's civil war and whether the Islamic State is a key player.
The real players are the Al-Qaeda-linked groups and some of the other more extreme Islamist groups.
Also ahead, retaking Mosul from IS fighters.
Mosul is the largest city under control of the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. They've held it for almost 2 years, and the Iraqi government taking it back would be a huge setback for the Islamic State.
Also, choosing the next U.S. president and something new from Bruno Mars. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. The Syrian border village of Dabiq, which Turkish-backed Syrian rebels seized from the Islamic State on Sunday, holds little tactical value for IS, but is of major symbolic importance for the jihadist. VOA's Victor Beatty asked regional scholar Anthony Billingsley of the University of New South Wales if Turkey might have a twin goal of defeating the Islamic State and keeping Syrian Kurds away from the Turkish border.
I think your second point is the valid one. Yes, you're right. Dabiq is a tiny little town. You really have to dig deep into the maps to find it. The one implication, I think, for Islamic State or in particular is that it may undermine... They made such a big deal about this place and Armageddon occurring in Dabiq that the recruits that they might have been hoping to get may start to back away and say, well, wait on, you blokes aren't serious after all. The fact of it being Syrian Kurds under Turkish tutelage, well, first of all, you have to wonder how many of them are actually Syrian Kurds, but that's another issue. I think what Erdogan is up to mischief right across the border there, and I think he's trying very hard to make sure that he is a significant player in any outcomes that might ensue from the capture of Mosul, which sounds like it's imminent, plus developments in the Syrian conflict as well.
On Saturday, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said Turkey would push further south to create a 5,000-square-kilometer safe zone in Syria. Obviously, he's planning to stay for a while.
That's right, yeah. And he did this in Iraq, in the mountainous area, in the Kurdish area in Iraq. And I think this is a real problem because he's hoping to become a player. His policy up until recently was disastrous, really. He found himself totally isolated, and he had to make some very serious backflips with Putin, for example. But he has been talking all along about a so-called safe zone. The administration had been opposed to this because they felt that it would just be an opportunity for Islamic State to infiltrate defenseless civilians. Well, the reverse may be the case now, where the Turks can just come in and basically run a very large part of Syria. And any settlement that may emerge now will have to take into account Turkish interests.
What's the state of Islamic State in Syria now? Is it really back on its heels?
It is. Islamic State has never been a really significant player in the Syrian civil war. It's managed a few spectacular attacks around the place and that sort of thing. But its headquarters of Raqqa, the area that it has dominated, has been largely unpopulated. And to an extent, I think the Syrian government was happy just to say, well, okay, do what you like in there, but you're not really making much of an impact. The real players are the Al-Qaeda-linked groups and some of the other more extreme Islamist groups. So Islamic State is starting to suffer. The fact that they withdrew from Dabiq, despite Turkish claims, I think they pulled out without too much resistance, unlike earlier conflicts on the border. I think they're being tactical there. They're quite happy to pull out, and then maybe they'll come back again at a later date or whatever. They've shown considerable tactical flexibility in this conflict.
Anthony, on the diplomatic front, Britain and the U.S. Sunday said they're considering additional sanctions on Syria and Russia for their activities in the Syrian conflict. Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson said that he thought it was highly dubious Syria, backed by Russia, was able to retake the rebel-held part of Aleppo. That's rather an amazing statement.
Well, it is, given that, you know, there's nothing getting through to the rebels now, very little in terms of food aid and the waters. I don't know whether the water has still been cut off, but, you know, the situation for the civilian population is just dire. And there's only, they think, perhaps 1,000 rebel fighters in that part of Aleppo. And remember, we're only talking about a quarter of the city. The rest of the city is government held. I would accept that it's going to be very hard for the government to take the rest of Aleppo without massive, not that the destruction has been massive anyway, but almost total obliteration of that part of the city. We've had the UN, de Mistura, the representative, the general, Health Secretary General, saying to the fighters, I will give you free passage, I will escort you out personally if you will just stop the fighting because there is no point.
Anthony Billingsley, Professor of Middle East Politics and International Law at the University of New South Wales in Kensington, Australia. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beattie. Among the other stories we're covering here on VOA, another failed missile launch by North Korea. Russian president dismisses the U.S. hacking claims. Plus, BRICS countries deepening economic engagement to combat terror. Expanded coverage of those stories, a lot more, at our website, voanews.com, and on the VOA mobile app. Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi has announced the formal start of a military push to remove the Islamic State from the northern city of Mosul. The announcement on state television today signals the opening of the largest military operation in that country since U.S. forces left 5 years ago. For some perspective, International Edition's Lori London speaks with longtime reporter in Iraq, David Enders, who says, in one sense, the move to retake Mosul had already been underway.
Mosul is the largest city under control of the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. They've held it for almost 2 years, and the Iraqi government taking it back would be a huge setback for the Islamic State. It would be the loss of the largest city they control.
Why now, and what would be different this time?
This is happening now because the Iraqi government has wanted this to happen as soon as possible for a long time. Whether some of the timing is related to optics vis-a-vis the U.S. election, sometimes this happens, that's for someone else to say. But it does seem that after a considerable amount of bombing, the U.S. has been bombing Mosul almost since the Islamic State took it over. And so in that sense, the operation has already begun, and it's been ongoing for a long time. And slowly the different Iraqi factions fighting the Islamic State, including the Iraqi army, have encircled Mosul, and in past weeks have made increasing pushes increasingly closer to the city. What will be different with the taking of Mosul as opposed to other Iraqi cities such as Ramadi and Tikrit that the Islamic State has had under its control, or had under its control for similar amounts of time, is that Mosul is much larger, and they're more likely much better dug in. They've exercised full control over the city for much longer than they exercised full control over some of those other cities. And given its symbolic importance, it's the only city that Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the leader of the Islamic State, has publicly appeared in when he actually announced the creation of the Islamic State. It's hugely symbolic, and it's likely they'll fight hard for it. It's also entirely possible they'll attempt to withdraw towards Syria, westward. And there are even hints that the Iraqi government forces may actually allow this to happen, hoping that the Islamic State will choose to fight another day rather than to make a stand in Mosul.
Does it appear that they're likely to be successful?
Well, the Iraqi government is backed by the U.S. military. So if success is physically taking over the city of Mosul, they are likely to be successful. I mean, the United States has launched thousands and thousands of airstrikes against targets in that area. One term the military uses is they're softening Mosul. They're softening a target. And so that's been ongoing, and this might be the time where we find out how effective that military campaign has been, whether or not they have, as they often claim, successfully destroyed Islamic State infrastructure, destroyed financial operations, communications, military, and other leaders within the group. So it may well be that they're in some serious trouble, and there are reports coming out of the city that there is resistance amongst the local population to the Islamic State, which is unsurprising. But the amount of that resistance might also make a huge difference in the campaign. There's the possibility that a number of fighters in Mosul joined out of convenience or necessity once the city was taken over. If people go back to when Mosul was actually taken over two summers ago, almost 2.5 years ago, it fell very quickly. And so people literally went to bed one night and then found out the next morning their city is controlled by the Islamic State. It took a few more days for them to take it over than that. But so people then, had some really fast decisions to make, and some of them, for whatever reason, joined out of convenience. And these people may not fight quite as hard or may turn on the Islamic State, and that could be a significant dynamic as well.
That is David Enders, longtime reporter in Iraq. He was speaking with International Edition's Lori London. This is VOA.
Do you know the political process that determines who the next president of the United States will be? Tune in to VOA's extensive coverage of the campaigns, the voting, and the final tallying to find out how citizens choose their next president. Right here on VOA.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Turning now to U.S. politics, where Republican Party presidential candidate Donald Trump has conceded that he is losing support among female voters, but he blamed it on media accounts of women who he says have falsely accused him of making unwanted advances on them.
The election is being rigged by corrupt media pushing false allegations and outright lies in an effort to elect Hillary Clinton president. But we are going to stop it. We are not going to back down.
Trump said on his Twitter account that national surveys show his campaign against Hillary Clinton remains close, but says he has, in his words, lost large numbers of women voters based on made-up events that never happened. A national average of polls compiled by Real Clear Politics shows Clinton with a 5.5% lead over Trump. Two major polls were released on Sunday, the Washington Post ABC News survey showing her average at 47-43% among likely voters, while NBC and the Wall Street Journal said their polling shows Clinton with a bigger edge, 48-37%. VOA's Michael Bowman speaks with my colleague Jim Stevenson about whether Trump is treading into uncharted waters for U.S. politics.
Jim, we are still 3 weeks away from voting day in the United States, but already Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump is sounding the alarm that he believes that there is some monkey business going on, that there is a campaign against him, that the election is rigged, that the election will be stolen. No one really knows exactly what he might say on election night if, in fact, he loses. But this does open up the possibility that one of the great traditions of American politics might fall by the wayside this year, which is the concession speech. Every losing presidential candidate comes out and says, I accept the results. I have called up my opponent. I have spoken. I have congratulated him. And I'm ready to move along. And I hope that the country will rally behind our new leader. This is something that Mitt Romney did for Barack Obama 4 years ago, that John McCain did for Barack Obama 8 years ago. This is something that Al Gore did for George W. Bush in 2000 once the Supreme Court had settled the matter and effectively said that George Bush had won the election. This is a longstanding American tradition, and it is important institutionally in that it confers legitimacy on the new leader when you have that leader's opponent conceding. And we don't know how this will play out. And in fact, we don't even know that Trump will lose. But if he does lose and if he does refuse to concede, this would be a first and a quite unsettling first for the nation.
Hinting at that as rather dangerous ramifications, I mean, all through this process, from the primaries all the way up to the big race, you see a series of concessions and consolidations as people fall out of the race, come together with the eventual winner all the way up to the top. And this is how we as a society have always kind of stuck together, even if the particular candidate that we didn't care for ended up winning. Ultimately, Americans support that candidate.
There's no indication that whatever Donald Trump might say, that a majority of Americans would therefore view Hillary Clinton as an illegitimate president. However, we do know that Donald Trump has a core group of supporters, and it's not a small group by any means. And if millions upon millions of Americans believe Donald Trump and take him at his word that the election is stolen, what does that mean for governing the country? What sort of effects might we see on election day if their supporters go to polling places believing that there are forces at work to steal the election? What sort of conflicts might we see breaking out at polling locations across the country? Might there be some sort of unrest after the election? We just don't know. But this is something that those of us who look at the statements that are being made right now, it's certainly a possibility that we have to consider.
The voters decide one way or another. They're the ones who ultimately decide which way this thing goes. To say that 3 weeks out, that could be a possible stance of somebody who, in fact, is very far behind.
Well, that is, in fact, what the Democrats are saying. The vice presidential nominee, Tim Kaine, was on the various Sunday television shows saying, look, this is someone who thinks he's going to lose and is trying to make excuses beforehand and to point blame at everyone but himself.
That is VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman speaking with International Edition's Jim Stevenson. By the way, Americans go to the polls on November 8th to elect the next president. Well, it's time now to look at what's trending on social media, and our own social media expert, G. Abby Lee, is here. What you got, G?
Hi, Steve. The first story has to do with the European Union, but more specifically, about the United Kingdom. The UK is facing a nationwide Marmite shortage after the Brits voted to leave the EU. Long story short, the country's largest supermarket, Tesco, stopped online sales of Marmite due to price increases thanks to Brexit.
Oh yeah, that could be a huge problem there. Explain to those listening to us now what Marmite is.
Sure. It's probably an unfamiliar product to many people unless you grew up in the UK or a former British colony like I did. It's a very common spread that people use on toast, but unlike jelly or chocolate hazelnut spread, it's thick and pungent.
I understand, and how is that affecting social media?
People are using hashtag MarmiteGate to share their concerns, and of course, given that it's the internet, jokes. Some people are tweeting, need to panic buy and resell on eBay, and others are saying they're disappointed the trending hashtag is not Marmageddon. What do you like better?
I don't know. You know, I'm kind of tired of the whole gate thing, the Marmite gate or Marmageddon. Yeah, Marmageddon, I think.
I see. I also want to reiterate that the Marmite shortage is trending on social media because this is really the first tangible effect of Brexit for many Brits.
And there must be something else out there trending.
The next item is about technology. There is a relatively simple hack going around on social media that will turn your phone into more or less like the new Google handset called Pixel. What it will do is add the Google Assistant feature if you can make two tweaks in a single configuration file. Google Assistant is the Apple iPhone's Siri equivalent, which works like a digital assistant that lives on your phone. But I say relatively simple because it does require a basic knowledge of coding.
I gotcha. What are people saying about it?
Well, a lot of people who wanted to get a Pixel but wanted to save some money will find it really cool, but since the how-to is posted publicly, the company will likely change the loophole so people can't do that anymore. That's all for me today, Steve.
Yeah, I understand, Gee. I've got a basic idea of coding. No idea at all. That's how basic it is. Many thanks, Gee. International Editions, Gee Abby Lee. Good to have you with us. By the way, you can follow Gee on Twitter at Gee Abby Lee. I'm there as well at VOA Norman. And our program, International Edition, is on Twitter at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
The International Diabetes Foundation predicts that 1 in 10 people will have diabetes by 2040. Treatment for diabetes can include 1 or 2 painful injections of the hormone insulin every day. Scientists at Niagara University say they've developed an ideal transport system that can withstand some of the harsh environments of the human body and effectively deliver insulin where it needs to go without the need for those painful shots. The insulin is contained in a small capsule made of naturally produced lipid molecules or fatty acids. The researchers found the capsules can travel undamaged through the digestive system, and then cells in the bloodstream take them in and release the insulin. The researchers presented their findings at the 252nd National Meeting and Exposition of the American Chemical Society in Philadelphia. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
It is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us this Monday. You know, singer Bruno Mars is releasing a new album and a single as well, and my colleague Sarah Williams talks to VOA Border Crossings host Larry London about it all.
First of all, happy birthday to Bruno Mars. He celebrated a birthday on October 8th, and he is celebrating in a big way. He's just released a brand new single, which is the title track, at least it is for now, from his upcoming third album, 24 Karat Magic. Bruno Mars, you may recall, about a year ago or so, performed the halftime show at the Super Bowl and had a number one song with Uptown Funk, you know, which was produced by and created by Mark Ronson, but spent quite a few weeks at number one. Everybody loves the song Uptown Funk. And now he's back with an upcoming new album. It'll be his third album. And Bruno Mars is one of the most talented performers in the business. People love his style, love his vibe, love his voice. And this new album will feature a little bit of a change for Bruno Mars. He's going to go the route of the electronic dance music producer. He's working with Skrillex and a number of other folks, not doing as much with his backup band known as The Hooligan. So this time around, he's doing something different. But it's going to be Bruno Mars, just like you know him. So why don't we check out the new song, 24 Karat Magic.
Tonight.
This is interesting, Larry, because we've talked before about these electronic, electronic dance?
Yep, EDM, which is the new craze, Skrillex and Afrojack and Calvin Harris and David Guetta, and the list goes on and on. All of these DJ-type producers are creating music that is just dominating the pop scene right now.
Why is it so popular?
Well, I asked Flume that. He's an Australian electronic dance music producer who's been nominated for 11 Australian Recording Industry Association Awards. And what he said was, it's the beat, it's the vibe, it's the feel in the music. It's a lot of energy. And that's what people love, especially when they see an EDM producer live in a concert. It's that energy and the vibe that they bring to the music that they work with.
But then poor Bruno Mars band. They must feel a bit neglected.
Well, I'm sure they're at home counting their money because the first two albums did very, very well. And I would assume that they're going to go on tour with him as well when he announces his tour, probably in 2017. But right now, he's enjoying the new single. A lot of people have been waiting several years for the new single. 2014 was the big year. He won some Grammys. He won 4 Grammys in all. He's had 5 number one songs go to the top of the charts faster than any other artist. He beat his own idol, Elvis Presley. Here's a little known fact that Bruno Mars, who grew up in Hawaii, his parents own an Elvis memorabilia store in Hawaii. They still own it to this day. And there was a time when he was 4 and 5 years old, 6 years old, he was called the youngest Elvis impersonator. In fact, he played a little Elvis in the movie Leaving Las Vegas with Nicolas Cage.
I was just going to ask you, did he go to Las Vegas at that time?
Yes, and you know what? It's ironic how things go full cycle because he's just signed a deal with MGM International. He's going back to Las Vegas because he's going to be the headliner for a while as the regular house performer at the MGM Grand in Las Vegas. But he's going to do other MGM properties. For example, he's performing at the end of this year in Maryland. He's doing several shows at the MGM property here in Maryland, and then it's back to Las Vegas. So he's all over the place, but his music is great, and I really am excited, because I'm a fan myself, for the new single 24 Karat Magic.
Sounds like he's doing really well.
He's doing well. Continues to do well.
Thanks very much, Larry. That's Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossings.
Something a little different for Bruno, but you know, I like it too. Very good. Hey, listen, the Smithsonian's National Portrait Gallery, just a block or so from the studios here, honoring Nobel laureate Bob Dylan. They're going to install a portrait of the singer-songwriter in the museum Celebrate space. They're going to do that later today, as a matter of fact. You'll remember that Dylan was awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature last week. The portrait they're going to hang was taken by the famed photographer John Cohen. That was back in 1962. It's one of two that the gallery owns. Good deal. Hey, listen, thanks everyone for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. Always good to have you with us. Latest world news is straight ahead. For our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Chaz Hall, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Monday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Economic progress for Nigeria's most vulnerable population improved in October, thanks to a new agreement between the United States of America and the government of Nigeria. On October 5th, the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, announced $92.73 million in additional developmental assistance to support the five-year $2.3 billion agreement signed with the Nigerian government in 2015. The assistance agreement announced in Abuja brings the total of developmental assistance provided to $474.74 million. This funding will continue to help Nigeria reduce extreme poverty in a more stable democratic society. Activities will stimulate inclusive economic growth, promote a healthier, more educated population, and strengthen good governance. We are pleased to contribute additional funding in support of the agreement signed with the Nigerian government in 2015, said USAID Mission Director Michael Harvey. With their leadership, we know this funding will have a significant impact on the well-being of Nigerians, he added. In an effort to align Nigeria's development plans with sector-specific strategies, USAID collaborated with the Nigerian Ministry of Budget and National Planning, the Nigerian Ministries of Health, Agriculture, Power, and Education, and state-level government counterparts to structure the agreement, which is in place until 2020. In addition to the developmental funding, the United States provides humanitarian assistance to people affected by the ongoing conflict and severe food insecurity in Nigeria and throughout the Lake Chad Basin. Since fiscal year 2015, the United States has provided more than $366 million in humanitarian assistance and continues to be the single largest bilateral humanitarian donor to the region. About USAID. USAID partners to end extreme poverty and promote resilient, democratic societies while advancing our security and prosperity. In its partnership with Nigeria, the United States strengthens social stability through social services, supports transparent and accountable governance, promotes a more market-led economy, and enhances Nigeria's capacity as a responsible regional and trade partner. The United States is proud to work with its partner Nigeria to promote the prosperity and well-being of the people of Nigeria, the region, and the world.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.